She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World, and we are disruptors for good. We are game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. And if you cannot tell, we love it, and I hope you can. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of our world. And a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, Tanks Green Stuff, formerly known as the Fairfax Companies. They are a locally owned company that produces an award-winning organic compost product made from landscape trimmings, green waste that would otherwise go to the landfill, and the landfills are full enough. Their manufacturing facility right here in Tucson, Arizona, uses the most stringent criteria to ensure quality, purity, and consistency for their compost. It's a big deal. It's a thing. Tank Screen Stuff, 100% organic soil amendment, contains no fertilizers or petrochemical additives. That matters too. And they always test for vital nutrients, pathogens, and heavy metals to make sure their compost is the best and highest quality available on the market today. And their company is a great partner of ours and supports our community in many, many ways, including providing compost at no cost to schools and other nonprofits when asked. For information about their product and where it can be purchased, visit tanksgreenstuff.com, and I really hope you do. Think Tanks Green Stuff. So I'm very excited about this show today for lots of reasons, including my personal admiration and respect for our guest, for his passion, for his commitment to making a difference for the planet, and for his kick-ass sense of humor. He's really funny, and I love spending time with him. We are going to be learning a great deal about protecting the fishing cat from our in-studio guest, Dr. Ashwin Naidu. He is co-founder and president of the Fishing Cat Conservancy. Ashwin, it really is wonderful to have you here. It's long overdue.
Oh, thank you so much, Gina. This is a wonderful, wonderful pleasure, and I'm so excited to be here.
I know, we're going to fly through this hour because, I mean, everybody in my listening world just loves how inside our worlds we get with our guests, and this is a really great story. There's so many pieces to it. So I wanted to start by asking the obvious question is, what is a fishing cat? But I think it's more important, like, we work up to that a little bit, because I want you to tell people about your background and how this journey led you from a career in engineering to one of wildlife conservation to one of studying this mysterious, elusive fishing cat. And it has to include, this story has to include the amazing gift your mother gave to you and your father, a trip to the Serengeti. So you get to go now.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it has been an amazing journey. And the fact is, the funniest part is, you know, I'm an Indian from India. That's how I introduce myself. And I've grown up in India with all, you know, whatever you imagine about India, I have probably at some point experienced that. And as I went on to do my engineering degree, I was like, oh man, I'm in my teens right now, and I'm really excited to do so many things. I used to play in a rock band. And
what, you know, a pass. There's a lot I don't know about Ashwin, but I want to know it all.
So I was obviously very influenced by the Western culture, and I was, you know, a bass guitarist for my band at that time back in India while I was doing my engineering degree. And I thought, oh, what an amazing future being, you know, a rock star of some kind. little did I know that, you know, I'd end up doing what I do. But talking about what happened during the final year, or just when I was about to finish my engineering degree, my mom She's a doctor. She's a gynecologist, and she was working in Tanzania at that time. My dad and I had never taken an international trip, a trip outside of India. And so we took the opportunity of visiting my mom in Tanzania, and we flew to Tanzania to spend time with her. And at the same time, my mom had saved up just enough money to send my dad and me to this world-renowned national park, which at that time I didn't know of, the Serengeti.
Oh, it's like, that is like a dream.
It is a dream.
A dream come true, the Serengeti. It's like, it's on my bucket list.
And it was a life changer. I was so enamored and enthralled by the amazing wildlife out there. You know, we were traveling with these two field guides.
Were their names really Tom and Jerry?
Yes, their names.
I don't think so.
believe it or not, Thomas and Jerry were their names. And, you know, we were sitting around the campfire and we were connecting with each other. And they were talking about how they knew all the Indian movies and Bollywood. And they were talking about Shah Rukh Khan and Amitabh Bachchan. And I was like, wow, you guys really like Bollywood music. And, you know, obviously I was trying to help out, cook some meals with them around the campfire. And they were like, you are just like our brother. you can just call us Tom and Jerry. and I was so happy because I'd always been, you know, itching to call them Tom and Jerry. And they're like, yeah, sure, you know. And, you know, the best part about people in Tanzania, at least from what I received, was they're very warm and they shake hands in a very different way. And if I were to shake your hand right now, Gina.
Too bad we don't have video.
Right. You know, I'm holding your hand here, my right hand, but I also use my left hand to.
Wow.
Cup it from the top and kind of give you that warm
so
feeling.
So it's very intentional.
It is,
yes.
Very.
Yes.
And so the warmth of the people, you know, gave me this new perspective. But again, what inspired me the most was their connection to their landscape and how they really were proud about their wildlife and how they were talking about every animal's behavior in such great detail. And they knew every species, every, you know, every bird, every mammal, every snake. And I was so blown away in my mind thinking, wow, these guys know so much. And so that essentially told me, okay, what, I mean, I love wildlife and maybe I can try to do something to save wildlife or help wildlife, or there should be a field out there that actually works to protect wildlife, something like a profession. And so when I went back, I started looking and doing some research about, well, my degree is in engineering and biotechnology.
Right.
How can I apply an engineering degree in biotechnology toward wildlife? And after a few months of research, I found out there is actually several organizations in my home country in India that work to protect animals like tigers. And there was a Tiger Conservation Society, the Hyderabad Tiger Conservation Society, which was working to protect tigers in my own city. And I was able to connect with them, and also another research organization called the Center for Cellular and Molecular Biology, which was working to study tigers using molecular genetics. And I'm going, wow, there's a tie-in.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so eventually that led me to collecting tiger poop in the heart of India.
You knew we had
India.
To talk about poop because when I first met you, you had a shirt on that said Scat Man. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. I don't think I knew your name for 2 years. I just called you Scat Man.
Man.
And I knew it was Ashwin, but you did have, a lot of interest in poop.
Right. And so that collection of poop and analysis of poop and discovery of tigers, and then eventually, you know, I met my, we went to present that research in Oxford University and in this conference for wildcats around the world. There were 300 cat specialist group cat specialists who congregated at this felid biology and conservation conference in Oxford. And that's where I met Dr. Melanie Culver, who was my master's and PhD advisor. And I was so lucky to meet her because I was talking to her about how my research in India, you know, analyzing poop had helped discover a tiger and how it's actually helping, you know, with this, with the protection of tigers in South Central India. Then eventually I got invited by her to study mountain lions here in Arizona. And it was a dream come true for me. And little did I know that when I got here, Melanie handed me a box of mountain lion poop and said, here you go, here's your master's.
Here's your present. So, but tell us why. There's a reason that you really do learn so much from poop, from scat. What do you learn?
Well, poop has a lot of information. We all, you know, think it might be waste in many ways, but to the biologist or to the conservationist,
it's a treasure.
It's a treasure. Truly is. There are many names to it, like it's the gold mine or it's the black gold, or it is the treasure, because when we were looking for mountain lion poop in the desert here in southwestern Arizona, poop was a scarce resource. And when we did find poop, we would store it and take it back to the lab and extract DNA from it. Now, this DNA comes from the surface of the poop and also from the components inside of the poop. But basically, the surface part tells you, once you extract DNA and you sequence it and you do all the analysis, you amplify the DNA and you sequence it, you come to know what species it is, whether it's a mountain lion, a bobcat, or a coyote.
Wow.
And funny story. There was a lady, maybe from this neighborhood out, forget her name. I think it her name was Lynn. I don't remember her last name, but I remember her sending a nice big sample of poop. And she asked me, how do I send it to your lab? Because I want to know what it is. It came from her backyard. And with it, she sent me a bag of cookies thanking me for the analysis. And I'm sitting there in the lab with the poop sample and the bag of cookies going,
okay,
which one do I open first?
But that's pretty amazing, though.
And
seriously.
So we found out that poop was a coyote, and she was glad. She thought it was a mountain lion in her backyard.
So, but to go to that extent, that is dedication. I mean, seriously.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the stuff... It got so exciting analyzing poop and identifying species. We actually took this to the next level during my master's and PhD. We used the DNA to not only tell what animal it came from, but what the animal ate. So extracting DNA from the prey components, we could tell what species it ate. Like if a mountain lion ate bighorn sheep or mule deer, and we could actually come up with a prey profile, like
wow,
a diet profile.
So really applied science in a very important way.
Absolutely. And then that didn't stop there. We could sex the animal. We could tell whether the animal was a male or was male or female. We could, you know, use the DNA to compare with the larger population and see who's related to whom. So kind of like coming up with a map of relatedness across the landscape. And not just samples from scat or poop. We were able to get samples from tissues from dead animals and animals that had been harvested and actually come up with this huge landscape genetic analysis and identify whether things like highways were causing an impact to mountain lions. So
wow.
That was part of my dissertation, is this huge 700 sample landscape genetic analysis of mountain lions across the state and beyond the state. And what I found out was, you know, there were genetic subpopulations of mountain lions, and highways could be one of the factors causing habitat fragmentation.
Yeah, and we just got a notice. I'm in this homeowners association, you know, email listserv, mm-hmm. and there have been quite a few sightings in this neighborhood recently. And I just think people should be aware of that, because if there's a mountain lion in your neighborhood, be aware. They don't usually attack humans. I don't know of any human attacks in Arizona, but their dogs are prey. So just be careful and be conscious. And I can guarantee you from this point on for the rest of my life, I will never look at poop out in the wild again without thinking of you. So there's the association. No, but that's very interesting to me that you can tell that much from scat. It's really... pretty incredible. I didn't have any idea. I figured you could figure out what they ate, but the DNA sequencing and all of that, that's a shock. Yeah. So, and you were part of the, I always want to give a shout out to the Carson Scholars Program at the University of Arizona, because my friend Diana Liverman started that, and it is one of my favorite programs at the University of Arizona. It just showcases the work of people like you. It's how I met you and many others, people that go and live on the top of the canopy in Ecuador and all of that.
It's amazing.
It is. It's pretty amazing.
I second that too. Carson Scholars completely changed my life the way, you know, my mentors in the Carson Scholarship Program taught me how to communicate science has completely transitioned.
It's so important.
It was a big pivot.
And here you sit. okay, so we have to figure out how to segue from what you were doing. And then fast forward, you are the president and co-founder of the Fishing Cat Conservancy. So I think it's great to start. How did this happen? How did this segue happen? Because it's really a fascinating story. For as much as we joke, I didn't know about a fishing cat. I didn't know about their importance or their contribution to our planet. So just tell us the story.
Very simply put, I loved cats and I wanted to do something for wild cats in the wild. And so after I finished studying cats, in many ways, I did my studies on tigers, leopards, mountain lions, and bobcats. I started looking deeper into the world of wild cats and did this own independent study of myself, I call it. I plotted the endangerment index of all the world's wild cats and how endangered they are. Turns out... across all the 40 wildcat species in the world, there are many wildcats in Asia, where I'm from, that are either threatened, endangered, or critically endangered. And so I was thinking to myself and going, oh, I know several languages in India. I know how to speak Tamil. I know how to speak a little bit of Bengali. I know how to speak Hindi. I know how to speak Telugu.
That's all? I'm sitting here and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Okay, moving on.
What can I do? I mean, I love connecting with people. I mean, this kind of came to me naturally, even going back to the experience in Serengeti where I was sitting and connecting with these field guides. I knew I had to do something at the community level. And so I was thinking to myself, how can I combine my strengths to address the conservation of an endangered wild cat? And I looked at this graph and I went, there is a cat called the fishing cat that is probably more endangered than tigers right now, because very few people know about it. You know, if you don't know about it.
I don't think anybody knows about it except you and the people. I'm not even being sarcastic. It's like a fishing cat. I was like, whoa, you got to be kidding. I thought it was just like any kind of cat that fishes. And it's indeed not.
Right. So it when I started looking at you know, this cat that loves water and cat that lives on fish, and, you know, obviously I quote it, I say, they are fishing awesome, you know.
They are fishing awesome.
And so I looked at their distribution and I found out that they're not much is known about them, so very few places have them. Where they live in wetlands, or they live in these forests called mangrove forests. And so when I was finishing up my dissertation, I took this result. I was thinking to myself, I was like, what can I apply all that I've learned and all that I've learned, not just for my dissertation and for my PhD and master's, but all that I've learned from all the fantastic people, the mentors, the coaches that I've had, the people who have influenced me in my life. How do I apply that to protecting this endangered species? And it led me to form the Fishing Cat Conservancy.
Okay, so hold that thought, because we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, all of this leads to the importance of preserving them in cooperation or in connection with, is a better way, with the mangrove forests. And we're going to learn a lot about that and why they contribute to cooling down the planet. Everybody stay here with me. More from Ashwin Naidu when we get back. 30 seconds.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. And just a brief personal, heartfelt request from me and the Mrs. Green's World team. If you love these podcasts, which I know a lot of you do, you know that we are doing our part to create a global community of people who truly care about this planet, about our health, and about the health of those we love. We need your help to continue and expand our work. You can join our movement by visiting MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member. And we really hope that you will join us in leading the charge to combat global warming through our robust and inspiring educational platforms, including this podcast. So we are here learning so much about fishing cats and their contribution to our health and the health of the planet. Joining me for this hour is Dr. Ashwin Naidu, co-founder and president of the Fishing Cat Conservancy, an organization whose mission is to promote the long-term survival of fishing cats in the wild through public education, capacity building, and community-based research and conservation. Ashwin, it is so great to have you here. So let's tie this into, it was fascinating when I had lunch with you yesterday, learning about the importance of the mangrove forests and watching your TED Talk and listening to the ABC podcast and hearing from you about, we've got to pay attention to this. It's like a no-brainer. So tell us about, you're now president of the Fishing Cat Conservancy.
Thank you, Gina. So I was talking to you about how the Fishing Cat Conservancy had formed. And so the idea was we were trying to focus our efforts to protect the fishing cat. But what we learned is when we started looking for these cats, we found that these cats inhabit these unique ecosystems. Now, we learned that fishing cats love water and love fish and live near these wetland ecosystems. But when we discovered where these cats live, we found in coastal South India, we were looking along the rivers, we were looking in around the lakes. But mostly where we found their signs was in these forests that grow where freshwater from the rivers meets saltwater from the oceans. And these are none other than the mangrove forests. And so, with fishing cats being living in these forests, we've found that it's not about the cat, it's about its habitat.
Got it.
And when we started spending time with local people, we learned from them that they are intricately and inseparably dependent on these ecosystems for their own survival. So mangroves not only provided habitat for fishing cats, but they also provided for human livelihoods. But then we discovered that along with fishing cats, there are many other species like smooth-coated otters, jungle cats, sea turtles, rays like mobula rays and stingrays and sharks, And
so their own ecosystem right there, the mangrove ecosystem.
Right.
Yes. Incredible.
And then there were hundreds, in fact, if you look at mangroves across South and Southeast Asia, probably thousands of bird species.
Birds.
That use mangroves for their life cycles. And so what we looked at was this entire ecosystem supporting millions of livelihoods from wildlife to humans. And then we started researching the importance of mangroves. And we learned that mangroves not only do this, but they protect coastlines. They are the first line of defense.
Against a tsunami. I read that.
Between tsunamis,
yes,
and coastal communities.
Yeah.
And they are also they prevent soil erosion and they hold the coastline together. But the icing on the cake to me when I was looking into this was from a climate change perspective, mangroves sequester or store more than 5 times the carbon as tropical forests. And so when I was looking at it going, oh, wow, that means protecting 1 acre of mangroves is probably protecting 5 or more acres of tropical forests.
It's mind-blowing. That statistic is mind-blowing, especially since I talked to you about Drawdown. That's Project Drawdown with, you know, Paul Hawken and Catherine Wilkinson. It's unreal when you told me that. And why don't people know it? Like, I've been doing this for 10 years, very immersed in my work, and I had no idea. It should be in Project Drawdown. You didn't know about the book. That's why, or it would have been selected.
Well, I'm hoping that I know that there is a lot of information out there on the importance of protecting mangrove ecosystems, but now I think this is a great time to be invested in mangrove ecosystems in many ways, because I'd like to share with you a story that will be very compelling, and that is of the mangrove man of India. Now, this person, his name is Aparao. And while we were searching for the fishing cat, we had come across this person in coastal South India. And he had performed some game-changing magic, which we didn't know about. So when we were sitting around sharing stories, Aparao was talking about, oh, yeah, I thought I heard something like the fishing cat, but I didn't know it was here. If I'd have known, we would have made some efforts to protect it. Now, this man is a community representative, and he is a conservationist from the community. And so, in many ways, he was involved with conservation efforts from protecting mangrove ecosystems to educating the local community about the importance of protecting these ecosystems. So, what we learned is that he and the local community there were funded by the Andhra Pradesh Forest Department and a World Bank initiative to restore mangroves. And what had happened was the reason why we had lost mangroves is because of the unsustainable practices of aquaculture and agriculture. And if you go, and the simple evidence of this comes from the grocery stores. If you go to your grocery stores and you pick up a package of fish or shrimp,
right,
it will probably say farm-raised,
right,
product of India, product of Thailand, product of Indonesia, product of Vietnam. And most of this is coming from areas or aquaculture farms that were originally mangrove forests.
Okay.
And so scientists estimate anywhere between 50 to 80% of the historic mangrove cover that used to exist in South and Southeast Asia. However, communities can change and can reverse this problem. And this is where we started realizing that we can combat the problem of climate change, and we can also combat the problem of socioeconomic problems to local people. And wildlife conservation and climate change action can go hand in hand with securing human livelihoods. So what we learn is that Aparao, the mangrove man of India, and the local community in coastal South India had, between 2005 and 2011, had worked to restore more than 27,000 acres of mangroves.
Wow.
From abandoned fish and shrimp farms back to secondary growth mangroves. And I wish we could show pictures on a radio show, but
I do too, but maybe we can get some things for our website when we promote the show. Seriously.
You can go to Google Earth and look at the change in the landscape. You can scroll that historic slider back to 2005 and look at all the degraded or abandoned fish and shrimp farms encroached on mangrove forests. And if you scroll it up to 2010, 2011, it's restored to secondary growth mangroves. And you can clearly see the difference. The best part, when we set up cameras in many of these restored areas or where mangroves were growing back, we found fishing cats.
And I was just going to ask you, so just why are the aquaculture, that business, is it, you said it's unsustainable. Why are they being abandoned? What happened?
So aquaculture farming is largely unsustainable because of the fact that these concentrated ponds when people or farmers grow either one kind of shrimp or one kind of fish, whatever it is they're growing, over time the pond has very minimal circulation. And so a lot of these nutrients get accumulated, and a lot of pollutants also at the same time get accumulated. So most of the times aquaculture farms just dump all this, and of course they add a lot of chemicals to try to
And antibiotics. I mean, it's pretty
antibiotics.
If I were a fish eater, which I am not, that would be probably the thing I would do the most research about before I ate it, where it came from, how it was raised. I mean, I've had guests on the show, and scientists tell me they don't eat fish anymore because they're sure there's mercury in every sample of fish. So there's reasons to really research what you're eating if you are going to eat fish, because it can really harm your health.
Absolutely. And so if you look at these aquaculture farms, they're dumping a lot of these polluted waters into the rivers, and it's a huge environmental impact. But on the other hand, the reason why it's unsustainable also is because of the fact that farmers have to maintain aquaculture farms. They have to pump chemicals. They have to, in fact, in some cases, after 2 or 3 years of productivity, they have to dig out the bottom layer of the soil and put fresh soil in, or just remove that layer. And it takes a lot of time and effort to do that, and money to do that.
Yeah, labor and cost intensive. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's not like you just plant it and come back and water it.
Right.
Right.
And so, you know, from the mangrove restoration example, we know that if these lands, you know, the reason why people abandon fish and shrimp farms is because they don't have the money to repair them, replenish them, and bring them back to the productivity levels that they had expected them to be. And so from that, we know that, yes, there's a problem there, that their sustainability is an issue. But from the mangrove restoration, we know that there's a possibility of restoring these degraded lands mangroves. Now, mangroves are a constant supply of fish, shrimp, and crabs because they are naturally productive.
On their own. So is that where the source of livelihood comes from? Because, I mean, you said they are the first line of defense for natural disasters, their habitats of species, all pluses. And so that's how they provide livelihood, from the natural production, and hopefully not over farming, over fishing, over, you know, using what's there so it can be replenished.
Right. And so you've identified the exact thing that I was trying to point to. And it's absolutely true that mangroves are a source of livelihoods. So if you combine these two solutions to these two problems, you'll see that sustainable harvest of fish and shrimp and crabs from mangroves is a potential solution, as it used to be. People used to use their boats to go and hand harvest fish, shrimp, and crabs from their natural boats. Like some of these fishermen, if you look, they use you know, these boats made out of coconut trees. And it's pretty amazing to see local fishermen harvest these, excuse me.
It's really okay. You should take a sip of water. It's what happens when you get on the radio. It's like I don't usually have dry mouth, and then I start on the radio. So it's okay. Like I said to you, we're human beings on this radio show, and we cough.
Yes. So going back to combining these solutions to these problems of unsustainability, we see that mangroves can be as productive as equally productive as they protect coastlines and provide habitat to the species, they can also provide for human beings. So what we're looking into is the solution of bringing in this mangrove culture among local people. So when we work with local people these days, you know, after we've done all this work of discovering fishing cats and mapping their presence and involving and educating local people about these cats and about the importance of protecting their habitat, what we're doing right now is we're trying to work with local people to restore mangrove forests for their own benefit, which means that they don't have, if they restore a mangrove, an acre of mangroves in an area where they had a fish and shrimp farm, they don't have to pump it with chemicals. They don't have to maintain it. They have zero maintenance costs, but they will always get a constant supply of sustainable fish and shrimp so long as they regulate it and they see, okay, fine, this is a source of income. Now, it doesn't stop there with mangroves. If you have an acre of mangroves, you are, of course, you may not have the yield that you'd expect from a farm. But you'll have a constant supply of fish, shrimp, and crabs. But think about the additional benefits. A mangrove patch can attract people from other areas and bring in ecotourists.
Ecotourism, huge, huge.
And if done properly, it can supplement their income. On top of that, imagine the circulation of carbon credits in the market in the future. Now imagine applying those carbon credits and giving them to people who plant mangroves.
Who are committed to doing this work. So I want to ask you, what does it look like? What does it take to restore a mangrove? What does it look like? Like, what do they have to do? Take out the old aqua farms, and what do they have to do? What's the restoration process look like? There's my question.
That's a fantastic question. Surprisingly, mangrove restoration is very simple. From what we've seen, the idea is to get saltwater and freshwater to mix and have the right salinity levels where mangrove forests grow. And mangroves self-regulate their growth based on the amount of salinity that exists in the water. And so the idea is to what we've seen from the mangrove restoration efforts that have happened in coastal South India, we've seen that people have created these fishbone structures that allow for the mixing of water, and they've planted these mangrove saplings into these furrows and ridges. And lo and behold, in less than 5 years,
then nature writes itself.
It does.
Nature takes over.
It takes over.
It's not man came in, screwed it up, destroyed a lot of the natural habitat, and it's almost like do a little bit and then get out of the way, and nature will write itself.
Right, absolutely. And if you talk to the local people, they'll say the same thing. We don't ask the crabs to come and make those holes. They come in and do it themselves.
Crab homes for sale. That's not what happens. But it's a really beautiful story about the circle of life and what can happen if we live in harmony with the earth, as opposed to, you know, man coming in and not being conscious of that and still being able to supply revenue and an economy that's healthy by just doing it right. And it's, of course, more healthy, not just for the planet, but for the people doing the work, for the people consuming the fish. Because, I mean, I'm sure that's a big part of their diets, the people that live in that area. So we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, I think we should talk a little bit more about the work of your organization, because you have lots of projects in mind. And then when we come back, here's going to be the big reveal. We are going to ask Ashwin how many fishing cats he has seen in the wild. So I hope everybody will stay with us. I really want to hear about your, you know, the components of the Fishing Cat Conservancy. And then, of course, how people might be able to help support your work. Everybody, stay here with me. We'll be right back. Lots of good stuff.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for being a part of it. And just remember that we are disruptors for good. And by listening to this, so are you. We're game changers, doing the good thing, the right thing, not just for ourselves, but for all beings who call the earth home. And in that blessing now is included fishing cats. We are learning fascinating information about protecting the fishing cat and their importance to the circle of life. It's like I'm so reflective about this show because of the role they play, where their habitat is. It's all the story of how we can live in harmony with Mother Earth. And Dr. Ashwin Naidu you are a rock star. Maybe not a rock band star, but you're a rock star, co-founder and president of the Fishing Cat Conservancy. And again, thank you so much for being here so that we can learn. It's not a metaphor, it's an analogy of what can happen and the whole part of about, science-based research that you're incorporating into what you're doing. I think that's really important too, science-based conservation efforts anyway. So, okay, I just have to set the stage. I've known Ashwin, it's probably 7 years, maybe six, I don't know. It's been a while and I love it when I see him, my face lights up and we always chat. And so I listened to a podcast that he did, and this was after I had lunch with him yesterday and have known him for this long. And the woman was great, it was a great podcast, and she said something about Ashwin never having seen a fishing cat. So is that true? Let's do rumor control. Have you ever seen a fishing cat? You're dedicating your life to saving them. Have you seen one?
I was going to be very shy and proud about the fact that I've never seen a wild cat that I've worked on throughout my career, but I would like to say that I've seen
one. That's amazing, though. That's so powerful. Seriously, you've seen them on camera. I watched a lot of those pictures of the hidden cameras.
Right. So we've set a lot of wildlife cameras to research the wildcats that we've worked on as biologists, but we rarely ever get to see them in the wild just like that, even though we spend a lot of time in the wild. And it's a similar story in my case. With fishing cats, we've documented them so extensively with cameras and videos and tracking them in the wild, but it has been a challenge to see one in the wild. And I believe we had this one time when we were on the boat in the middle of the night with our
getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. I mean, I was cringing listening to this podcast. I'm like, I'm never doing that with him. I can tell you that right now.
Yeah.
Get a picture for
definitely
me.
Definitely have your mosquito repellent on you when you're out in South and Southeast Asia. So the exciting part was, yes, we knew that this cat hangs out around this area, and I did see this pair of eyes shining back in the light, and the figure looked like a cat. Now, I don't know if it's a jungle cat.
I don't know if it's
a fishing cat. It was a cat.
But you saw the eyes.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd like to believe that it's a fishing cat, but, you know, as a scientist, I always have to say that if you don't have evidence to show for it, you haven't seen one. And so...
So it doesn't count. The green eyes did not make the cut for one.
Yeah, and it's funny. Just a couple of months ago, I was again, you know, in India, we were out with the Andhra Pradesh Forest Department on their boat. And, you know, again, you know, the excitement. Oh, stop. We see a cat in the mangroves. And, you know, our prime tracker, he is his name is Moshi. He used to be a poacher. He used to hunt fishing cats, and he now works for conservation because you know, he's an excellent tracker. And when we met him, we involved him in our conservation efforts. He's actually employed in conservation right now, and he's getting his entire community to protect fishing cats instead. So it's an amazing story about Moshi. But Moshi looked at the same eyes shine back, and he's like, no, that's a jungle cat, don't worry about it.
And we're, it was like, a great story. And I'm thinking a lot about this, that these things that you're doing, to me sitting here, sound very exciting. I'm a wildlife nut. I really want to go to Africa. I want to go to India, only if I'm going with someone like you. And I mean that. I would need somebody. When I went my trip to the Amazon rainforest, having the guides and the people that know the land and the terrain and the animals and all of that, it makes it all, I don't want to go as a tourist. I want to go as a friend of the wherever I'm going so that I can learn the most that I can. But anyway, it you see it through different eyes. But to me, the fact that you've dedicated your life to this, and it's a big deal because of when the carbon sequester, it is a big deal anyway. But when you think about the mangrove forest and what an important contribution that could make to our global warming situation, it blew me away. So what about, so we have established that Ashwin has not seen, we don't think so, but anyway, I think it speaks volumes about your passion and your commitment, and I hope your mother is very happy that she gave you that trip to the Serengeti.
Oh, she is. She's incredibly proud.
And your dad's really supportive too. I certainly picked that up. He does some field research for you if you can't.
Yeah, absolutely. He's fully involved. I say that he's volunteered his retirement for fishing cat conservation.
It's wherever. Clear. When I don't know, I pick that up through a lot of things, but he's on board with helping you make this happen.
Absolutely. Couldn't do it without his help.
So tell me an overview of the Fishing Cat Conservancy. There are many components that are well thought out. So one part is obviously field research, which have ascertained I do not want to be a part of. I just want to
it's
see
it's a lot them. Of fun getting your feet muddy and stuck.
I'll just pass on that. Really, it's okay. I'll believe your stories. And then what about, you wrote on the website, I saw capacity building. What do you mean by capacity building? Such an important part of it.
The most important part of our work, I would say, is capacity building, because we try to share all the scientific knowledge that we have and that we've gained. In fact, it is community-based research and conservation that is solving these problems or these bringing up these solutions. And the idea with capacity building is to share that knowledge, the global knowledge that exists. So just to give you a small nugget of what capacity building is, I talked about Moshi, the ex-poacher, he's a tribal member who, you know, his community used to hunt fishing cats for, you know, as part of their survival. And they truly are dependent on these ecosystems for their survival. And so when they start, you know, when we started talking to Moshi, we learned about their dependence on these ecosystems. But we also learned that they also have the issue that, oh my God, we are losing these forests that we survive on. And so what we told Moshi is, like, we are here to protect the forests. We're here to protect this endangered species. Can we work together? And so when Moshi joined our team, we started equipping him with things like wildlife cameras and...
Right, the tools needed, yes.
And training him in the modern wildlife research techniques that are out there. Now, he was an excellent tracker coming in from the hunter's perspective. He knew, you know, which cat this track belonged to. And so combining his traditional ecological knowledge with the modern wildlife research techniques and technology that we have and the scientific methodology that exists, we were able to create an excellent team for conservation. And so right now, as we speak, Moshi is collecting information from wildlife cameras, reporting these data to our field team, which is in turn, you know, just to give you a small example of his discovery, he helped discover two new populations of fishing cats. And these were in these isolated patches of mangroves in coastal South India that were cut off from many of the larger mangrove patches.
They are so elusive.
Right.
I mean, I went to the rainforest, half of our canoe saw a jaguar. My half did not, and I'm still sad about it. I'll be sad about it forever. But you're right. To see one, lots of the people that live in the Amazon have never seen one.
Right.
They are elusive. So I understand.
So getting information on these elusive cats and providing that information to the forest departments and the authorities has really helped. And believe it or not, this last month, it was the first time when we introduced Moshi to the forest department and said, here is an ex-poacher who used to hunt fishing cats. He's actually protecting them and discovering their populations and sharing all this knowledge on their existence in these mangrove forests. And the forest department was seriously impressed, and they said, we should make an effort to employ these people who know wildlife.
Yes.
And they started harnessing the idea very positively and appreciated the fact that Moshi is, you know, they are also interested in conservation. Now, as humans, we are all interested in protection of natural resources because natural resources provide for our livelihoods. And so I think the idea is to connect one another. And so with capacity building, our idea, when we share knowledge and we learn from local people, we create this knowledge hub that everyone can utilize for the common goal of protecting these mangrove forests for everyone's benefit.
And so I do have to ask this. It's the question on the table. Does he have to collect scat too? Because I'm obsessed now to know. Is that part of the modern research?
it is. Yes, there are several instances where, for example, Moshi has pointed at scat, and you know he of course concludes directly. Oh, that's a fishing cat, or
right,
that's a jungle
right,
cat,
right.
And so. But one of our students recently, she's actually our first woman conservationist. Her name is Leela. We're trying to get her to study fishing cat scat and identify, you know, if it's a fishing cat. And
scat
then
woman.
Scat woman.
You get a whole line of T-shirts and hats and all that, selling them on your website.
So, yeah, that would be amazing to test people's knowledge. Oh, yeah, you think that's a fishing cat scat? Okay, let me test that out for you.
Yes.
Let me see if you're right or wrong on that.
Oh, my gosh. I always wonder when I see it. I never know if it's a cat or a porcupine or a skunk or a bobcat or whatever, but I have to take you on some of my treks. So capacity building, so much sense. And then you've kind of woven this into the conversation, but you're really doing conservation education as well, like
right.
In the communities, even with Moshi. Mm-hmm. That to me, I think that's an example of conservation education, because if you destroy your habitat, you have no livelihood.
Right.
So, and if you keep destroying it, we'll have no planet. So
right.
That's a part of your efforts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Right now, our big focus is conservation education. One of our lead field conservation, our recent lead field conservationist, his name is Pranav, and he works very closely with Leela, who is our first woman field conservationist. And we also have another very talented field conservationist. His name is Srikant. And so Pranav, Srikant, and Leela are out there right now who are they are working to educate school children, colleges,
wow.
and the youth. And so what the way we've designed this is we have to get into the schools among the villages that are right next to these mangrove habitats. So there are these village schools which have kids, both girls and boys, that are, you know, either entering their teens or just
right.
Before their teens. And they're really excited. And believe it or not, when we go out and distribute these photos of fishing cats and we talk to them about fishing cats on mangroves, they are super excited in protecting in doing what they really want to help protect them. And they know about them in many ways because they've probably heard the folklore, and some of them probably even seen them in their villages, seen fishing cats in their villages. And so they are really excited. And so it's a re-inspiration to our team in general when we speak to kids and see their bright faces, all for the idea of protecting these cats and the mangrove forest that they so depend on. And so if you look at some of the images, they are proudly holding up fishing cat.
The images are delightful. I mean, I have a big grin on my face. Someday we're going to be able to videotape these things because it's just, it was delightful. It was so fun spending time doing research for this. The kids are delightful.
Absolutely.
They're adorable and they're excited.
And they're the future of our ecosystems.
They're certainly the future of this country. I can tell you that right now. Look what's happening around our country with kids calling for, gun control. They're waking lots of us up.
Right.
So, and then the last piece for this part is conservation action. What are your calls to action? How do you inspire them? What do you, inspire them to do? I don't want to say tell them, but instruct them or give them the opportunity to do in terms of conservation action, which is a critical piece.
Definitely a very critical piece. And it is the landscape changing part of our work. So if we, as simple as it sounds, if we pitch up a signboard in this village talking about the importance of fishing cats and mangroves, the idea that local people look at that signboard and go, okay, we're supposed to stop any poaching of fishing cats, and we're supposed to not cut mangrove forests because they protect us. That is an influence to the community and a knowledge to the community, which the community themselves take an action to protect them. And this was evident from one of our recent visits to a small village next to a 1.2 square kilometer mangrove patch that has fishing cats, smooth-coated otters, jackals, and jungle cats. It's this village called Bendamur Lanka, or Ben, as we call it for short. The villagers in that village were proud about protecting their backyard mangrove forest.
Yeah.
And they were proudly telling us, we actively prevent poachers to come in and take away any wild animals from this mangrove patch. And because we know this forest is important to our survival. And so that was a very refreshing, positive change that we've seen among local people, is a shift in mindset. And that leads to other conservation actions, which include mangrove restoration and the fact that people are now embracing the idea of silviculture, about mangrove culture. What I try to call it is the shift in mindset from aquaculture to mangrove culture. And so if we can, we've already spoken to a few farmers and they're interested in planting an acre of mangroves, just to compare that with their regular aquaculture farming practices and to see if it can benefit them over the long run. And that little change,
which
there,
you know it can. Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that little change is a conservation action that can change the face of the planet, the fate of the planet in many ways, right? So that part to us is our ultimate goal with Fishing Cat Conservancy. This is our mighty mission. We want to protect 10,000 fishing cats, or at least 1,000 fishing cats to begin with. But the idea is to see 10,000 in the wild so that,
your goal is to see one, yes.
Is to hopefully protect so many in the wild so that they're no more endangered, and restore or protect 100,000 acres of their habitat, which could be mangrove forests or wetlands, and educate and involve 1 million people within 10 years. And if we are able to do that, then we can leave behind something.
You're changing the world. I mean, it's a legacy. So obviously, supporting this organization matters. We're going to have to wrap up, but you can find out more about all of this by visiting fishingcatconservancy.org. And I hope you do. I hope you put it on your list and say, this is a gift I can give myself, to look at it, to consider supporting it, because it matters to all of us. It comes back to us 100-fold. And Ashwin, I just have to say this. I love you, man.
Thank you so much,
it was
Gina.
So
I love you
great.
More.
Thanks for being
really
here.
Really appreciate it.